This is Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ SSD. All right, so continuing on with the Poor People's Campaign, the Roots Action Seminar on the Poor People's Campaign. Just to let you know, the websites, because, you know, you can, there are people actually working on anti-war, and they just need your support. WorldBeyondWar.org, AmericansWhoTellTheTruth.org, WarIsACrime.org, and DiffuseNuclearWar.org. And see, the mainstream media doesn't tell you this, but there's actually people working on solutions to these problems. And we know the solutions. We've known them for years. And it's the corporate oligarchs that stop us from doing it, who want a hierarchical world where a few people have obscene amounts of wealth and the rest of us sit around scraping the crumbs. Okay, so like I say, there are people with a solution. It is not hopeless. We just need to inform people, which is what we do here at KPW. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media, because that's where you're going to find the people that are working on viable solutions. All right, so coming up, part three of the Roots Action Seminar on the Poor People's Campaign, featuring Daniel Ellsberg, who, personally, I met him at Nevada Test Site, which was awesome that he showed up at Nevada Test Site at least 2 years in a row, where, again, they stopped above-ground nuclear testing with just a handful of people. Maybe 1,000 people. Still, comparatively a handful of people. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
Campaigns, Senator Nina Turner, who is a hell-raising humanitarian and a tireless advocate for progressive values and social justice. She made history in 2005 and 2008 as the first woman and African-American woman, respectively, to represent those districts. She promoted progressive policies through her work with the Ohio Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, in 2016 and 2020's presidential campaigns and during her time at Our Revolution. Senator Turner is a former assistant professor of history at Cuyahoga Community College and the host of Hello Somebody podcast. She is currently the host and executive producer of Unbossed, a show that airs daily on the Young Turks Network. My sister, please take it away.
Thank you, honey. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone. And one of the privileges on being on a panel like this, everything that I would have said has been said. I mean, everybody has been truly magnificent. And I'm seeing people either by name or by face that I haven't had a chance to fellowship with in a very long time. I'm honored to be one of the soldiers on the battlefield with each and every one of you, a battlefield of peace. And maybe that might seem contradictory, but we have got to get as not just committed, but just to be really out there as much as the other side is. I mean, I could quote each and every one of you, but things that are sticking with me right now, what Reverend Theo Harris just said about this budget, which was in my notes too, and it just does boggle my mind. Sister India brought up what the urban poet Tupac said about money for war can't feed the poor, that is timeless. It just reminds me of how when I was on the floor of the Senate, and I'm quoting the founders and also Tupac at the same time, just dazzled them. They just couldn't believe it. Yeah, because I do this thing a whole different way. The knowledge and vision comes from many places and spaces and not just people with special titles. What is done in our name matters. I saw in the chat a question, you know, if they're using taxpayers' dollars to pay for war, are we, you know, is that basically about us? And I kind of pondered that just a little while. What they do in our name matters, and they are the policymakers, and particularly on the federal level. But there is indeed, as Reverend McBride laid out, as Corey laid out, and so many others, there is a link between what we do internationally and what we do domestically, I just had the opportunity to be in New Orleans with a group of some of the best economists in this country. And one of the things, you know, being a senior fellow at the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy, to have economists talking about how we can create a moral political economy. Well, we're having that conversation tonight about what it is going to take to create a moral political economy. Part of that is understanding that we cannot spend all of our money in war making. $858 billion budget, and that doesn't count at all. And I think it was Reverend Theo Harris who laid out the fact that they gave the president this time in his budget more than what he even asked for, and that all each and every one of these presidents, and you have a Congress in a bipartisan way, they cannot renew the child tax credit, but bipartisanly they can increase the Pentagon budget. There is something immoral about this, and we have to call it what it is. And to see so many faith leaders, we need faith leaders on the freedom fighting progressive left to have as much chutzpah as the evangelicals have on the right. Because what would Jesus do? Not this foolishness and folly that these folks are doing in our name. What they do in our name matters. Brother Corey brought up the letter to the Birmingham jail, and I had right in front of me Reverend McBride, which I read every single year about this time, is Dr. Cornel West's The Radical King. See, like Reverend McBride said, you know, they can sit up there and mess around with the I Have a Dream speech, but what you cannot do is wrongly critique what Dr. King had to say about militarism, poverty, racism, and materialism. So you can't get that one twisted. And so what we're going to find on the MLK holiday is what we do find about this time every single year, is politicians on both sides of the aisle quoting Dr. King, but wouldn't understand what Dr. King was standing for if it smacked them in the face. It is bigger than quoting him on the King holiday. It is what you do in the people's name with the people's money, whether it's domestically or internationally. Now, while I do support what this country is doing by and large to be in fellowship, and I'm using that term lightly, with our sisters and brothers of the Ukraine. There are innocent Ukrainians dying, there are innocent Russians dying, there are innocent people all across this world dying. But for every dollar that is spent in the Ukraine or any other war-making activity, they should be spending $5 right here domestically. It is a sin and a shame to have so many people in a hegemonic nation like the United States of America go to bed hungry every single night. It is a sin and a shame that this Congress could not come together in a bipartisan way to expand and make permanent the child tax credit. But meanwhile, in the hoods where people are misunderstood, and I'm talking about the rural hoods, the urban hoods, and the suburban hoods, people have to grovel just to get a modicum of what it means to have a quality of life. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. would be mortified, and we all know it, and all like 250 of our family and friends who are on this call with us today, we all have a role to play in peacemaking. Norman, you may remember when Congressman Dennis Kucinich had pondered a Department of Peace. I'm old enough to remember, and they laughed at him. They thought that he was making a mockery. But back to something that Reverend McBride said, we got to begin to think in that way. If you think war, you're going to get war. And this is what this country does. And this country, by and large, has involved itself in the disruption of communities all over the world. The geopolitical leverage of this country is going in the wrong direction. What is done in our name? And we need more Americans to understand that we, none of us, it doesn't matter how hegemonic this nation is, we cannot withstand a WW3. So it is in our best interest to avoid war at all costs. And that's why I love this. Diplomacy is always in order for the most part. So I'm gonna take a page out of Brother Corey's book. I was ready for this. Not so much the Birmingham jail, but just a few notations from Dr. West's book, The Radical King. If you all have never read this book, I encourage you to read it. But just even in the introduction, even before you get deep down into the chapters, Dr. Cornel West lays it out like nobody else. So in writing the following, in King's eyes, too many black leaders sacrifice the truth for access to power or reduce sacrificial love and service to selfless expediency and personal gain. True that, Dr. Cornel West, and not just black leaders. We got white leaders. We got Hispanic leaders. We got leaders from all walks of life that all they care about is being invited to the Christmas party. They really not there to do the deep-seated work to make peace abound. And peace means peace in people's homes and their communities. Peace means having a living wage. Peace means being able to take a sick day. Hello, rail workers, that this president and this Congress betrayed. And if they come for the rail workers, they come in for the rest of us. Dr. Cornel West also laid out that the spiritual blackout, the lack of integrity and courage, primarily revealed a deep fear, failure of nerve, and spinelessness on behalf of black leaders. Black leaders in particular, because we know from whence we came or how I got over. My soul looks back and wonders how I got over. Black leaders in particular, but not black leaders exclusively. And then Dr. West goes on to say that the radical king was a warrior for peace on the domestic and global battlefield. Hello, Brother Corey. He was a staunch anti-colonial and anti-imperial thinker and fighter. His revolutionary commitment to nonviolent resistance in America and abroad tried to put a break on the escalating militarism running amok across the globe. We find ourselves in that same moment right now, because we have folks who really don't care. There's no other way to say it. And since we're in the presence of men and women with the cloth, I will not speak in tongues in the way that I know how real well, and that is in the form of cussing. For King, dissent did not mean disloyalty. Now, this is an important point, sisters and brothers and family and friends, because those of us who are gathered here tonight understand that we must dissent. We must stand up and speak a certain type of truth to power without fear of contradiction. For King, dissent did not mean disloyalty. In fact, dissent was a high form of patriotism. Hello, somebody. Can I get an amen? When he said that the U.S. government was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, let me pause right there. We are the only nation on the face of the earth that dropped an atomic bomb on another nation. Hello? We don't have any moral ground to stand on. But what we should be doing is learning from our mistakes and standing up and saying, I can testify to the fact that war does not equal peace. It never has, and it never will. He was not trashing America. He was telling the painful truth about a country he loved. There it is. And so because we love this country, we must continue to be disciples of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and any other religion that you attend to, in saying that we are going to stand up and speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help us God. And the truth of the matter in this moment is that this war making must stop, and diplomacy is always in order. And not only are we doing this for our ancestors, we're doing it for ourselves, and we are doing it for future generations, both in this nation and nations abroad. Because Dr. King did seal this thing up when he said, what happens to one directly happens to us all indirectly. We cannot live in peace when other folks have no peace. We can't live in peace when people are hungry. We cannot live in peace when folks are dying because they don't have the requisite health insurance that they need to live a good life. We cannot live in peace when people don't have a living wage. We cannot live in peace when we have leaders across the world who believe that flexing their muscles means killing other people at random. And that is what is happening. And the United States of America plays a particular role and should be using its hegemonic position to push for peace. Peace does not mean weakness. Hello? Love does not mean weakness. It takes a whole lot to be disciples of peace. And so I salute all of my sisters and brothers and family and friends who have joined us tonight, the panelists and the folks who are with us and unifying with us on this issue. I want you to know that you are on the right side of history. Diplomacy always has a place. And shout out to my sister India Walton, because I'm sure if she was mayor, what she described that happened in Buffalo would not be happening.
I have chills all over. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Turner, for your continual work with the progressive movement and just being such a beautiful leader. It brings me great pleasure to introduce our last speaker before we go to our call to action, who is a legend in his own right. Daniel Ellsberg is a former consultant to the Defense Department and the White House, specializing in problems of the command and control of nuclear weapons, nuclear war plans, and crises decision-making. He later joined the Defense Department and then the State Department. And in 1969, he photocopied the 7,000-page top secret McNamara study, which later became known as the Pentagon Paper, and gave it to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Daniel, please take it away.
Look, I very much regret that I didn't hear the first hour of this, because it was taking part in a live, unrecorded meeting that was going on with a number of Chinese, South Korean, Japanese scholars on prospects for nuclear proliferation and for these countries acquiring their own nuclear weapons at this point, and saying that the major purpose for this, the reason that has occasioned this right at this moment, is the war in Ukraine, which has brought home to them, and there was one from China here, but he had to listen and hear that the others were saying that that has made them aware that war can happen, can be real. And they didn't go on to say that nuclear threats are being made now in a way that we really haven't heard since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, if I'd stayed on that, and I told them I had to leave at six here for this one, and I'm so glad that I heard what I did, and I look forward to hearing the recording of the rest of it, I would have asked, and what will just happen to this state of transition to thinking about acquiring nuclear weapons if small nuclear weapons get used in Ukraine? Is that possible? Well, actually, we are hearing from President Putin that if he is faced with any prospect of losing parts of Russia, and he has named four districts in what was Ukraine, or what is Ukraine, or what he regards as formerly Ukraine, he has annexed those to Russia, so that if we go into parts of Donetsk, which he doesn't yet control, parts that he hasn't controlled yet, he will regard that as an attack on Russia, and he will defend it with, people are inferring, tactical nuclear weapons. Strictly speaking, he hasn't said what kind of nuclear weapons, but everybody assumes, well, he's not going to hit Washington in that sense, and I think that is a fair assumption. But to use Hiroshima-type, what they now regard as tactical nuclear weapons, short-range weapons, hard to imagine that unless he is faced with losing Donetsk and Luhansk, the eastern Donbass, or Crimea. And that is really not going to happen unless the U.S. comes into this, as it has not yet done with U.S. air power. Is that impossible, by the way, that that might happen? If they do come in, then I think the Russians will be facing the definite loss of their present positions in the Donbass, and would confront the world then with the prospect of Putin defending those areas, parts of Russia he now regards them, with the sum of the 1,000 to 2,000 tactical nuclear weapons that he has. How could that come about? Well, some Ukrainians might actually, in the atrocious conditions that they are now experiencing, could decide that some of those weapons we've given, and even more, the ones they're asking for, that with longer range, should be used against Russian bases in Russia, pre-war Russia, pre-this war, that are attacking them. Their planes that are attacking Ukraine are very likely now coming from inside Russia. And there have been attacks of various kinds, sabotage, guerrilla, but also missile attacks on those places in Russia. Could that happen from a Ukrainian? Possibly. they're under the gun, they're facing it, and they're talking about aims of forcing the Russians entirely out of Crimea and out of eastern Donbass. In other words, achieving and attain a territories that they haven't controlled since 2014. Now, there's, I think that's impossible. They can't do that without U.S. involvement. Could they actually feel, well, the time has come for some U.S. direct involvement in here? If they were actually to use those weapons against Russia, I think they could reach a point where Russia feels, or Putin feels, that he has to retaliate to that against supply bases in Poland or Romania that are now where all of our weapons are now coming through from that, from the U.S. That's a direct conflict with NATO. That would bring U.S. directly in, U.S. air. And I must say that I think a lot of Ukrainians pressing Putin, pressing Zelensky on this would welcome that and said, now we have a chance. Now the U.S. is here. Indeed, there would be, at that point, be a chance to achieve the aims that Zelensky has announced and that the U.S. has supported, which is total expulsion of all Russians that have been there since 2014, 8 years ago, from the territory of Ukraine. At that, and actually, that would bring it within the range of achievement. At that point now, the threats that Putin has been making since almost a year ago, February, a year ago, would be challenged. Does he carry them out or not? Now, if he was certain that that would blow up the world, that it was escalate to the full, which is possible, and he knows it's possible. But if he was highly likely that that would happen, that the U.S., that would lead to an escalation where everything goes, I don't think he would do that. I actually don't think he's crazier than we have been for the last half century. Why isn't the world saying those threats of Putin of initiating nuclear war where his territory, as he defines it, is threatened? Why isn't the world saying that's outrageous? That carries not only a threat of a mass massacre in Ukraine, it carries a real serious risk of killing nearly everyone. Omnicide, nuclear winter, a genuine risk of blowing up, and that is a real risk. How high is it? No one can say. It's not zero. So why isn't the world saying, that's including the U.S., everybody else saying, no. That's not only imprudent, it would be evil, monstrous, you know, absolutely immoral, unacceptable. Because the U.S. has been making the same threat for the last 70 years, essentially, and is making it right now in refusing to adopt no first use policy, that we will not initiate nuclear war. We can't say to Putin, that would be absolutely unforgivable and outrageous for you to do what we defended Berlin with for 50 years in NATO, and what we're still threatening in Taiwan, where they might have a conventional superiority. We, as long as we had a conventional inferiority in Europe, we relied on the threat of initiating nuclear war, and we prepared for it with ICBMs, with every kind of nuclear weapon that was capable of disarming the other, which was infeasible. But the effort to do that made it look likely we would do what we were threatening, which was to initiate nuclear war on a tactical level. By the same token, then, Putin is making the same threats that we always have. And is it possible that those could actually be triggered? It's not inevitable. Yes, it is possible, absolutely, in the way that I've just described. We could see an evolution from Ukraine going on here. Remember when a Polish base was actually hit by missile fragments or a missile, Zelensky immediately said, that's Russian and should involve a total response from NATO. A NATO country has been hit. Biden, of all people, immediately said, almost within hours, said, we're not sure that is from Russia. And within hours, they had decided it wasn't from Russia. It was Ukraine. It was a Ukrainian air defense missile that had gone over into Poland by mistake. Zelensky for all one can say to him, good or bad, did insist for days after all of NATO had said, had agreed, this was a Ukrainian missile. Said, no, I have no doubt that this was a Russian missile, which implied, you know, I have no doubt that the time has come for NATO to come into this directly, which, as I said, threatens everyone in the world if they're doing that. So that's a state of mind that's understandable for somebody under the kind of attack that Zelensky has. Yes, he would risk the world, as we have done repeatedly in the past. And both Khrushchev and Kennedy, who were not crazier, more reckless than anybody we've had since, were taking that risk time ago. So where are we today? I know we're over the time here together, but where are we coming? We've talked about that we must not be a war state, a war economy. We must not have a war economy. But that's what we are, and that's what we do have. We have a war economy, and people people who are voting for it are sustaining it in both parties. In fact, even the Progressive Caucus, with very few exceptions, if any, Barbara Lee being one on the whole, who votes for, but even on, in this particular case, I'm not sure even Barbara Lee dissented from this unprecedentedly large budget. What's going to change in the next year? I think it's very unlikely, but not impossible, that this war will be ended either in 6 months at the end of the winter season or next year. It can go on with this terrible loss of life on both sides and the constant risk of escalation, indeed, possibly to the end of the world, which answers all the problems, takes the final solution for human problems. But I would say more likely than that, just introduces a new era in which the people I was just discussing with, the Japanese, the South Koreans, the North Koreans, everybody gets nuclear weapons, and nuclear weapons are now not only being threatened, but being used. And we're on the verge of that. If this war continues as it is going on right now, which I think is highly likely, there is the risk of introducing a new era, however long it lasts before the whole thing blows up, of an era where everybody gets nuclear weapons and they use them in the conflicts that we're seeing all over the world, every kind of person. It is essential then, this war, in my opinion, stop. And the purpose, the point of this thing was diplomacy, negotiation. How many voices are there for that right now? Not in the White House. Not in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is one who has said that almost alone and was reproved by it immediately the other day. The defense secretary, Austin, was talking about bleeding the Russians until they can't attack places like Ukraine, for instance, Georgia, or can't attack Georgia, Russia. That's forever. Both sides are now naming conditions for going into negotiations, not for ending the war, conditions for talking that will never be achieved. Both sides are saying that. Putin saying, we don't talk unless you accept the reality that Eastern Ukraine, that the Donbas is Russia forever, and Crimea, and Kherson, and Zaporizhia. And that's not going to happen. And before they talk, no talking then, Zelensky says, we don't talk until you have gone back to the 2014 period before the coup in Ukraine. You're all out of Ukraine. No talking. That's not going to happen. So they're both saying the war goes on indefinitely without talking, without negotiating, without even discussing the possibility of ending this war. And I have to repeat, it's not only Russians and Ukrainians, both who are dying in this war, it is the risk of this new era of nuclear weapons, the risk to everybody in the world. So it is unconscionable. What we need precisely is the theme of this conference here right now. Yes, diplomacy has to start. The talking has to start right now. And that's no just you know, obvious. I mean, you might say, well, obviously it goes without saying. It does not go without saying, because to speak diplomacy is to be pressed down in the moment. Remember, 36 members of Congress, most of the progressive, no, not all of them, nearly all of the members of the Progressive Caucus actually called for nothing other than negotiations. And they were forced by Nancy Pelosi and obviously the president to change that within 24 hours. Ro Khanna alone said, no, that was the right idea. I'm not going to say it was not the right idea. But the Democrats said, oh, no, we're going into an election here. That sounds a little too much like the Republicans. By the way, does that mean the Republicans are going to end the war the middle again? The House? No, I don't think that's going to happen. But we don't want to sound like Republicans, so we can't even use the word diplomacy or negotiation. What I'm saying then is it's going to take a kind of moral courage backed up by other people with courage served that we have not seen in Congress yet, but it exists. You know, humans are capable of that, to start saying, no, we cannot fight this war until the Ukrainians achieve their perfectly reasonable goal of getting all Russians out of Crimea. That's not going to happen. That's for endless war. And let me just, there are major, strongest factions in this country who are quite happy for this war to go on indefinitely. It can't go on too long. Northrop Grumman, Lockheed, General Dynamics, Boeing, their stock has all gone up for good reason. The people who are buying that stock, if you don't care what you're supporting when you buy stock, if you don't have any moral scruples at all, good bet. Lockheed is a good investment for you. And they've wanted this. They have gotten what they wanted. In fact, beyond what they could have dreamed even. NATO back now with power. Russia as an enemy was just essential for NATO to continue existing and for the U.S. to be in charge of it. Defense budgets, as long as we can see, it's just great. So the major powers in this country, the richest part, the most influential, are very happy, and they are willing to take the risk, which they know as well as we do. There's a little risk here. It might all blow up. But meanwhile, the profits are going up. Quarterly profits are very good. That's all you need. So finally, and I know I'm over the time here, Pandia had mentioned to me or reminded me when I told her I couldn't come in at the very beginning, this is a commemoration of Martin Luther King. And I mentioned to her that in my book here, The Doomsday Machine, actually, I quoted King at the end. And maybe this particular passage has been quoted by others, and I'm sorry I didn't see it, but maybe not. Right at the end of the book, he warned us 1 year to the day before his death. There is such a thing as being too late. And by the way, I keep hearing, oh, 6 months from now, the people will be more willing to negotiate. I don't, by the way, think that's at all true. Or after another year or 2 years or something, that can be too late. It can be too late now. But he said there is such a thing. And challenging this, he said, we need to recognize the fierce urgency of now. And I'm saying negotiation cannot start too soon. There is no such thing as premature negotiation on this question, despite how it arose and everything else. He was speaking then, I said, here, the madness of Vietnam. And that was in 1967. He was really prophetic on that point, and he was denounced by nearly every newspaper in the country for going out of his area here, which was civil liberties and race relations and whatnot, and talking about the urgency of negotiation in Vietnam. Actually, that year we lost 10,000 men and killed close to a million. The year he died, 1968, 15,000 men, that was a high point, a year after his speech. But the war had 8 years to go in 1967, 5 years of heavy combat. Yes, it was not too early to be doing what he said. to negotiate. And remember, 15,000 American dead, which is what we count over here, not foreign dead, is twice what we've lost in 20 years in the Middle East. 20 years. Now, could Vietnam have gone on for 20 years? Yes, if you could get the deaths down to where we've gotten them so far, and in Ukraine, where we're not yet doing 20 years. Yes, the Ukraine war, 20 years would be fine, okay, with the places I've named. So he said, we still have a choice today, nonviolent coexistence. And by the way, that meant coexistence with Russia as it was, and it wasn't more democratic than it is now at that point. He was talking about Russia in 1967, or violent co-annihilation. And finally, it is the last paragraph of my book, we must lose Martin Luther King. We must move past indecision to action. If we do not act, and I think he was saying then and now, if we do not act to demand that our foreign policy not be based on supplying weapons to kill people, but demand on using our full influence, and we have the greatest influence, which we're using in the other direction, to keep Ukraine from negotiating, which they were willing to do almost a year ago in March and April, 10 months ago. And it was Boris Johnson of UK and the US who said, no, it's not time for negotiation. Keep it going. And they'll say the same 6 months and a year from now. If we do not act, we shall be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. And then he said, now let us begin. Last sentence here. Is it too late to avoid its co-annihilation? Actually, looking back from some other planet, it might be. Mm. But we can't know that. It's not possible to know that. We can't, no one can say we can't change this. It's impossible. Actually, the odds are against us, but they're not zero. And unless we do it, change this, I choose personally, and I know all of these people on this panel have lived their lives as if it were possible to change. And that was the right way to live. And as he said, now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world.
I will go to Ryan Black.
Bill has just posted a link to diffusenuclearwar.org/whatsatstake. And I would urge everyone to go there. And what we've done here is created a tool that allows you to, first off, email the president, your two senators, and the representative, and your representative, a message about nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons pose an existential threat to the survival of humanity. It is imperative that you and every other elected official give top priority to reviving nuclear weapon treaties and disarmament measures. Essential steps include concerted diplomatic efforts to bring the disastrous war in Ukraine to an end. Diplomacy is the path to peace. And then it urges them to visit diffusenuclearwar.org/whatsatstake, because after you send this message, you will be redirected to another page where you will be able to upload a photo of what's at stake for you when it comes to nuclear war. This is our kids, it's our families, it's our homes, it's our lives, it's everything that we've worked for. And this is our effort to try to build that moral authority again, to convince our representatives that there are really, really important things at stake here for us, and that nuclear war is no joke. It's pressing, it's very serious, and it needs to be dealt with right now. And then we will display many of those photos on the website, but more importantly, we're gonna print off those messages, we're gonna print off those photos, and we're gonna deliver them to the White House so that they see really pictures of the things that are most important to us. For me right now, it's, if this will show up, it's this little guy, my 18-month-old. We baked a cake yesterday, so it was a lot of fun. So that's what's at stake for me. So yeah, with that, please go to diffusenuclearwar.org/what's at stake and take action with us. We'd really appreciate it. And we got to do everything we can to prevent nuclear war.
Thank you so much, Ryan Black. Thank you, Norman Solomon, Huri Peterson-Smith, Pastor Mike McBride, the legendary, the wonderful Daniel Ellsberg, the great Senator Nina Turner, beloved India Walton, our lovely Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, David Swanson. And thank you from the bottom of my heart to Bill Lackamacker, who continues to show up on these calls and make the tech run smooth, because it is challenging. We'll be right back.
Jimmy Page, guitar.
Once, I was on a camping trip, and I got separated from my party. And then I was looking around, it was getting cold and dark, and I looked, and there was a giant sign that said, "Warning, you have entered the land of the three-name people." I was about to turn and run when Sarah Michelle Gellar came out and said, "This is the land of the three-name people. How many names do you have?" And then Jennifer Love Hewitt came out and said, "This is the land of the three-name people. How many names do you have?" And I said, "I have but two names." And then Ray Dawn Chung and Olivia Newton-John came out screaming, "Death to the two-name boy." And I started to run away when Sarah Jessica Parker, Mary Louise Parker, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus came out screaming, "Death to the two-name boy." And then Edward James Olmos, Harry Dean Stanton, Billy Bob Thornton, James Earl Jones, and Charles Nelson Reilly came out screaming, "Death to the two-name boy." And then Mark Paul Gosselaar, Tiffany Amber Thiessen, and Brian Austin Green came out and grabbed me and said, "Death to the two-name boy." And then a group of Gentiles came out and said, "Is this death to the Jew-name boy?" And I said, "No, two-name." And they said, "Oh, sorry for interrupting." And they just... And then Michael Clark Duncan, Neil Patrick Harris, David Ogden Steers, David Alan Greer, and David Hyde Pierce came out screaming, "Death to the two-name boy." And then just about everyone who has ever been a cast member on The Cosby Show came out screaming, "Death to the two-name boy." And then Lee Van Cleef, Lee Taylor Young, Jennifer Jason Lee, Cheryl Lee Ralph, Roscoe Lee Brown, Gina Lee Nolan, Rachel Lee Cook, Johnny Lee Miller, Tommy Lee Jones, Ricky Lee Jones, Jamie Lee Curtis, and David Lee Roth. And I pulled myself away, and I ran and ran and ran. So you did a lot of running. No, I ran and ran. So you did quite a bit. No, I ran for days and days and days. So what, a week? No, I ran. And then I collapsed. And when I woke up, a girl was leaning over me. And I said, "What is thy name, young wench?" And she said, "Madonna." And I said, "You only have one name? I have two." And at that point, Prince came out, and Sade, and Vanity, and Apollonia, and Brandy, and Topol, and Cher, and Contafloss, and Fabian, and Tiffany, and Charo, and Twiggy, and Liberace, and Jewel, and Sting. And they said, "In the land of the one-name boy, the two-name boy shall rule." And we danced and celebrated. And then I collapsed, because it was a pretty long week all in all. And when I woke up, leaning over me was Michael J. Fox, George C. Scott, David E. Kelly, Mary J. Blige, E. G. Marshall, C. Thomas Howell, M. Emmett Walsh, G. T. Walsh, Lee J. Cobb, James L. Brooks, G. D. Spradlin, Edward G. Robinson, S. J. Perlman, H.G. Wells, John C. Reilly, E.F. Hutton, J.P. Morgan, and Samuel L. Jackson, screaming, "Death to the man without the pretentious initials!"